Hello and welcome to What the Flick. It's officially summer!
Whoa!
Because I'm wearing black and you're in long sleeves. But you're cheerful. It's a cheerful shade.
Bright.
Here we are coming to you in 3D with Iron Man 3. Was Iron Man 2 in 3D? It wasn't. I don't remember.
I want to say no.
I want to say no because like, this is like prior to the advent of everything being in 3D. I'm Christy. That's Lonzo. We're going to have cuddly Iron Man 3 time. Please describe it to us.
So Tony Stark has survived the events of the Avengers. He saved the planet and is everybody's hero, but that does not keep him from having anxiety attacks and insomnia. So we're finding him kind of stressed out, kind of trying to figure out what's going to happen next. And to compound his problems, we get the Mandarin, played by Ben Kingsley, who is a Bin Laden-type terrorist who likes to do terrible things and then make videos about them, and a very creepy industrialist played by Guy Pearce with his own weird agenda. Take a look.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally, save the world. So am I. Can't I sleep?
You don't know who I am. You'll never see me coming.
The question, where is Tony Stark?
Things are different now. I have to protect the one thing that I can't live without.
That's you.
Do you want an empty life or a meaningful death?
You just died, pal. I'm gonna come get the body.
Yes, I was sort of surprised that this is more of a sequel to The Avengers than it is to Iron Man 2, which is smart and not, in that Iron Man 2, I think we can all agree, is probably the weakest of the three.
Yeah, I don't hate it the way people do, but it is the weakest.
I didn't hate it, no. But The Avengers was so great.
Totally, yes.
So to try to spin off of that seems rather ambitious on the part of Shane Black.
Well, and it's interesting. This is, I think, almost more a Shane Black movie than it is a Marvel movie.
True.
I mean, like, even the opening narration is Robert Downey saying something and then, like, saying, no, and then starting over again, which is right out of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
It's very self-referential, very knowing, yes.
Definitely. And it's a Christmas movie,
right.
You know, which he loves
to do. In
the
middle of the summer.
Exactly, yeah. Why not? And, you know, so there's a lot of Shane Black touches, you know, the big, giant, crazy action finale, you know, all that sort of stuff. Love, I mean, the banter is great. I like the way, I mean, Downey, you know, and Black have that sort of thing where certain actors say certain writers' dialogue in just the perfect way. And so I like them as a team. I like the way that Tony Stark deals with people and sort of blows them off or engages them. Like, he has this long relationship in the film with this kid who's helping him out at some point when he has no, you know, he's desperate and needs help. And he never treats the kid like anything but another annoying adult.
Right, you know. There's no coddling, and as a parent, I actually really, really appreciated that, because we all want to talk to kids that way all the time, like, get away, you're annoying, but he will do it.
Yeah.
Right, and he and Gwyneth Paltrow still have that great kind of crackling, old-school screwball comedy kind of chemistry, but this is, of course, still, first and foremost, a giant summer action movie.
Definitely.
And so... I don't know that the three necessarily adds anything, but there is some incredibly cool individual stuff in it. Incredibly cool set pieces.
Yes.
And the way he gets into the suit is so rad. So many different ways, so many different times. I don't want to give it away, because each time it's like, wow, that was cool. But there is something going on here, like in the movie Zapped. There is like Scott Baio, Willie Ames kind of telekinetic, like, come to me, you know, here's my armor and my stuff.
Without the skirts flying up.
No. But it's, at the same time, I feel like we're kind of spinning our wheels here.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think that like I said, I love the banter. I love the way that, I love the dialogue exchanges. Plot-wise, the Mandarin stuff doesn't, it kind of fizzles out. And then with the whole Guy Pearce thing, I'm not entirely sure what his agenda is and why, how the pieces fit together of his world-dominating plan.
Does he want an army? Is he trying to build an army? Because if so, wasn't that what was happening in Iron Man 2? Wasn't Sam Rockwell also building an army of people who are weapons?
Sort of, but also there's this whole thing of, like, if he wants to sort of create this thing where he's arming both sides, but it's like, well, then who's the other side? I mean, I don't want to get too into the weeds, leads with this, but it just
does the plot matter though? I mean, we think it does. Do you think the average person going to see an escapist summer movie cares about plot?
I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like it's not that it should be a big deal, but you need something. I mean, because I think that there are movies that are just all action all the time, and they don't do all that well. As much as people say, oh, I don't care about the plot, I just want to see stuff blow up, you want something kind of underpinning
cohesion.
Why is this blowing up? Why is this blowing up now? You know, that kind of thing. What I did like, and this is something that you see a lot of times in franchises where they sort of strip everything away and get back to the basics. Like, there's a scene where he's got no armor, but he goes to like a hardware store and just makes all these little doohickeys for himself, you know, because he is this mastermind like weapons creator, you know. So it was kind of cool, as much as all the putting on the armor stuff and the armor sequences are fun, that he also can just sort of work with whatever he can pick up at a Home Depot and still turn that into, you know,
something badass.
Exactly.
I just felt no arc with him this time. I felt like he was the same person all the time, and yes, there's a couple of moments where he has these little panic attacks, but he essentially is in control and quippy and funny and glib at all times. And I felt like with one of the great parts about Iron Man, the original Iron Man, was that there was the evolution of Tony Stark, and he had to find out who he truly was and what his purpose was. I don't know that he changes at all, so I felt really no emotional engagement here. It's cool looking, but I was never moved, and I didn't really care.
I think some of the glibness, though, is very clearly a defense mechanism. So even though he's being smart-assy with people, it's a lot of it coming out of a place of panic and a place of defense, you know, and you can sort of tell the difference between when he's sort of being natural, like with Gwyneth Paltrow, or when he's just using it as a way to put a wall between himself and people because he's got his own issues going on.
It's his shtick.
Exactly, yeah. what bothered me in this movie is that I love, like, this is so weird, I don't generally like her anywhere else, but I love Gwyneth Paltrow in these movies. I love Pepper Potts, and she's so fun.
She can be funny. Who knew?
Exactly, really. She's breezy and engaging. I don't know if it's that Downey brings it out of her. This movie vacillates back and forth between, like, at some point, she gets to put the armor on. You know, like, she's in there and acting on it. I'm thinking, yes, great, she's not just the girl, you know. But then at the end of the movie, until something else happens, she spends a good chunk of it just being, like, literally trapped under something heavy and going, ah!
Hanging upside down.
So perils of Pauline. Yes. I was like, come, really? Like, she's so helpless for so much of the film, it just feels like a cheat.
And needs to be rescued
character.
Still.
Exactly. Hmm. And I wasn't clear about the rules of this super weapon human thing that Guy Pearce has invented that can make, like, people regenerate limbs, but it also gives them these other powers, but sometimes they blow up and sometimes they don't.
Why
do they blow up? Yeah, like, explain to me why.
We need a flow chart.
So we know when there's a fight sequence, like, what has to be done to kill them? What's going to make them explode? Without knowing that, it's just this sort of random, like, thing that happens. That's what I think of the weakest part here is that there's not enough sort of ground rules for what we're dealing with.
Yeah, and yes, it is convoluted, and yes, there is this giant cast, but a movie, if we're going to compare it to The Avengers, since this essentially is a sequel to The Avengers, a movie like that did a much better job of, like, handling all the various moving parts and all of the characters and not forgetting anybody and making sure that everyone has time to shine, and yet it still has cohesion, to use that word. This feels like it botches it here and there. It kind of strains to find that balance.
But did you have fun?
Yeah, I had fun. I mean, I had fun, but I didn't care.
Okay.
I didn't feel emotionally engaged at all in anybody's struggle.
Yeah.
Shouldn't you? Or not?
A little helps, you know. But I'd say if you're a fan of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you'll have a good time with this. It has that sort of Shane Black, Robert Downey stuff. You just have to sort of get through the things that don't work, the things that aren't explained, and that don't mean anything.
And I would say that if you are a fan of the original Iron Man and did not like the second one, you will be happy that this returns to a place of better.
More on track.
Better. Okay. Better, gooder stuff.
Yay.
I write for
liking
a living.
Liking the things. Okay.
So please, numbers. Go ahead.
I think it's a 7.1. It's not a total success, but I had enough fun that I, you know, could forgive the things that didn't work.
I'm saying 6.4. I swear I like fun. I love the first Iron Man. It was on my top 10 list that year. So our average is 6.7. It is way higher in Tomato Land because it has been playing overseas for like a year at this point, it feels like. Everyone in Europe and England has seen this movie.
It's huge in China.
Yes.
Big opening weekend.
Because didn't they, like, add extra China stuff?
Yes. With I forget the actress's name, something Bing Bing, who's like big over there, and yeah, she gets a whole segment that we're not going to get to see. So
I would have liked to have seen that too. Why
maybe
not?
Maybe on the DVD.
So the average is 81% in Rotten Tomatoes, and but it's dropping a bit. It was like 90, and now it's dropping a bit. Okay. Now that we mean cold Americans are seeing it. Bye.
Hello? Oh, wow. He married her.
You insist.
Oh, darling.
Hello, and welcome to What the Flick. I am Christy. This is Alonzo. We are not getting married, but other people are in the big wedding. It's a big wedding.
It's a big wedding.
Hence the title.
It's a super generic title. Ben Barnes. Ben Barnes, thank you.
He's
and
really cute.
He, who from the Prince Caspian from the Narnia movies. And Amanda Seyfried are getting married. And so that means big, crazy family times. Barnes' adoptive parents are Robert De Niro and Diane Keaton, but they haven't lived together in ages because Robert De Niro left her for her best friend, played by Susan Sarandon. And De Niro and Keaton's biological kids, Katherine Heigl and Topher Grace, have issues of their own, as do Seyfried's parents, David
Seyfried.
I don't know. You don't even know, and you're correcting me.
I do. No, it is Seyfried.
Okay, fine. David Raich and Christine Ebersole. And so Ben Barnes' mother is Colombian and super Catholic, and so he asks De Niro and Keaton to pretend to be married so she doesn't get offended and craziness ensues. Take a look.
You know what your son just told me? Al's biological mother is under the impression that divorce is a great big fat sin.
Hell it is then.
She gave up her only son so that I could have a chance at a better life, and now she left Colombia only to find out that I've been lying about being raised by heathens for the past 15 years.
So this is an American English language remake of the French farce.
Right.
We don't do French farce very well here in America.
Not as a general rule.
It's strange.
No, but what I like about this movie, and I like this movie more than I dislike it, I like that it's an R-rated comedy that is an R-rated comedy. Like, it is naughty and bawdy, and people say, you know, blue. They work the blue material, you know?
Say, you can say the word that they use.
Like the opening sequence is like basically De Niro is about to perform oral sex on Susan Sarandon.
In the kitchen.
In the kitchen. And Diane Keaton is in the house, unbeknownst to them. I totally understand why people would avoid this movie like crazy. It has the word wedding in the title. It has Katherine Heigl in it. It has Robin Williams playing a Catholic priest.
Again,
after License to Wed. So, you know, it may just be that I went in with such low expectations that the fact that it didn't physically punch me in the face makes me like this movie. I laughed enough times. Like, you know, there are comedies that you don't laugh at all, and there's some you laugh constantly, and there's other ones that you laugh enough times that you feel like you've seen something that was not a total waste of your time.
I did not laugh enough times.
Okay, fair enough.
I laughed here and there.
Sure.
But for the most part, found it really hacky, really strained, and a huge waste of an enormously talented cast. I mean, because they are who they are, because Diane Keaton can just show up and be radiant, and just be lovely and breezy and funny and daffy, like.
But she's been in some crap movies.
Oh lately. Yes.
I mean, Because I Said So and Mad Money. I mean, so
Hanging Up in
2000. But
she's really like lovely and beautiful and funny in this here and there.
I think she and De Niro and Sarandon have fun together. Like they have a cool chemistry, and even though like they outshine the material like crazy, but just watching them interact is fun enough.
Watching them interact made me want to watch them interact with better material.
Well, absolutely, yes. No, I grant you that.
It's been depressing, actually.
A lot of it is strained. I think that Katherine Heigl, for once, is fun to watch because she's playing a character full of rage. And I thought that was funny because I'm so used to her being the sort of simpering romantic lead and just super irritating. And here she's playing, she just has the most like dead-eyed stare and says the most cutting things to people. And I'm like, oh, I like this Katherine Heigl.
No.
Like, I want more of this one.
I wanted that character to be developed better. Mm. I mean, I think she's an idea that is underdeveloped and feels kind of wedged in given the general wackiness of all the other hijinks that are going on. I like Topher Grace. So you like Katherine Heigl,
Topher Grace. No, he's fine.
But again,
that's a character that makes no sense. The 30-year-old virgin, you know, just seemed kind of...
He's this hot doctor.
Yeah.
He's never slept with anybody. but again, he does, like Robert Downey Jr., he does that kind of like quick, glib, kind of smart-ass,
yes.
weapon-fire material pretty well. Yeah, I just found this sad and depressing and trying so hard to shock us. The scene where De Niro's going down on what's her face? Saran in the kitchen. That just felt like it happened so fast. It felt like they were trying to shock us really quickly off the top.
I don't know. I don't want to sound like I'm defending this movie because it's not particularly great. But I think it's the perfect movie for when you have the flu and you're on the sofa under about like three blankets and you're half woozy with cold medicine. This is the kind of movie that you want to watch on HBO or whatever.
So you can fall asleep during it.
Not have missed much.
Yeah. No. And another great example though is you were not at the screening, but Dave and I were at the screening, which was sponsored by Coast 103.
Oh, I heard that was. Jamboree.
Which was the LA adult contemporary easy listening station where they have love songs on the coast at night. And that is kind of your target audience. You're people who are like, oh, I like Susan Sarandon. Oh, I like Katherine Heigl. Let's go see that movie.
Yeah, it's a mom movie if your mom doesn't mind discussion of like 9-hour orgasms or whatever, because it is an R-rated, movie.
Right.
And I kind of appreciate that because I feel like so many movies are so PG-13 and like, let's cover our tits with the sheet, and everything's they verge on naughty, but then they kind of pull back. So it's like, let's just have some R-rated movies every so often, and get a little down and dirty.
All right.
So yeah, not a great movie, but not the piece of shit that you might imagine it would be.
And there's your blurb.
Boom.
Okay, so what is your number, please?
What did I give it?
You gave it a six.
I give it a six, a solid six.
You're feeling very charitable. I give it a three. We should point out to you that it has an 8% positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and among the very few
mostly
positive
because of me.
Things, Alonzo feeling charitable that day. Our average here is a 4.5, but it is an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes. So beware.
Yeah,
be sick in bed.
Exactly. Get that flu and watch this movie.
Bye.
There it is.
Who else knows about this?
Just me and Galen.
Good. This boat's ours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to What the Flick. Christy Lemire, Alonzo Duralde, and we are putting on our waders and heading into the Mississippi River for some mud.
Yes, the reconnaissance continues with mud. So if you thought that Matthew McConaughey wasn't grungy enough or potentially evil enough in movies like Killer Joe or Magic Mike or what else?
Bernie and Lincoln Lawyer.
Lincoln Lawyer, right. So here he is, a full-on fugitive killer.
And his name is Mud.
His name is Mud, literally. But he is charming and charismatic, as he is wont to be as Matthew McConaughey. So this is about a couple of 14-year-old boys who hear that there is a boat lodged in a tree in their small town in Arkansas. And so they go to look for it, and they think it's empty. But Mud is living there. Take a look.
You know that guy? I've never seen him before.
What'd you say, boys?
You got crosses in your heels.
Nails, shaped like crosses.
What for?
Ward off evil spirits. I'm waiting on my girlfriend. She got these birds tattooed on her hands here. Nightingale.
So I really love this movie.
Me too.
I loved it. And this is from Jeff Nichols, who wrote and directed Take Shelter, which was extraordinary and beautiful. And this very similarly takes its time in telling its story and has a real feel for its geography and for the people. And it's production designed like impeccably. Mm-hmm. And the skies are vast and beautiful and dark and strange. And it's a tremendous cast. These kids are great in it. Ty Sheridan, and you looked it up, the other kid.
Oh, God, I just told
Jacob
you.
Jacob Laughlin. Thank you very much.
As Neckbone, favorite character name of the year.
Yes, these are not precocious, cutesy little moppets.
No.
These are tough kids. And the actors playing them feel so real. It's like they're not even acting. And they are so lovely with Matthew McConaughey, and they evolve with him as far as being enamored of him and then finding out the truth about him.
Right.
And it's a coming of age movie, but there's something precious about it.
No, when this movie is working, and I think I'll get to where it falls apart for me a little, but when it's on and when it's doing what it does well, it reminded me of To Kill a Mockingbird, in a good way, and that's not something I throw around a lot. But the idea of these kids coming of age, getting involved in the lives of these adults, and sort of what they learn about the adult world and adult responsibilities and how adults delude themselves and others, felt really honest and genuine and not sort of fake movie-ish. Nichols creates this whole really interesting world. Like, I could have watched a whole movie about Ellis's parents, who are played by Ray McKinnon and Sarah Paulson, yes. who are in the process of separating and going through their own stuff. And I mean, you know, the mysterious neighbor played by Sam Shepard, mm-hmm. who pops up, the Mudd's longtime estranged girlfriend played by Reese Witherspoon. Yes. I mean, just all kind of factor in, and I think are you know, and they fit so well into the whole the larger world of the river and this island where the boat is and the small town, you know, on the banks in Arkansas and the Piggly Wiggly and everything. It all felt very genuine.
The Piggly Wiggly is like a character, and if you've lived in the South,
oh yeah,
you won't get why this matters.
They are essential.
But so you were going to get to a butt then. Well,
here's
like.
The yeah the All butt. Right. The last act of this movie, I think, suddenly overloads with. Incident, I guess. Like, a lot of things start happening.
Melodrama?
Like, there's, like, snake bites and shootouts and, you know, revelations and da-da-da-da. And it doesn't feel as of a piece with the rest, other part of the film, which, as you said, it takes its time. It's kind of laconic. It lets things play out. And also, I thought the kids who up till that point, or Ella certainly, who up to that point it was a very realistic 14-year-old in terms of his own, the way he communicates and his own thoughts and desires, suddenly, like, has a couple of speeches where he totally understands what's happening and how he feels about it in a way that I think a 14-year-old wouldn't.
Like when he finally breaks down and cries and unleashes on McConaughey?
Yeah, when his big confrontation with Mudd feels like a lot of understanding very fast for a character that probably would have taken longer to sort of figure it all out.
Now, I don't know. He strikes me as kind of a street smart kid, and he is an intelligent kid and kind of a street smart kid, so he's so... He's got all this pent-up stuff going on, and I believe that speech, because it's emotional. It's that horrible, awkward time when you're 14, and his illusions have all been shattered.
Sure.
So I kind of believe that speech. I'm not sure I always believe Reese Witherspoon's character.
Really?
Yeah, because, yes, she's an idea as far as McConaughey's perception of her, right?
Sure.
That she's beautiful, and then you actually see her, and she's kind of this, like, pretty, but... trashy barfly kind of chick,
right? And certainly he does not live up to the pedestal that he's put her on in terms of the way she behaves.
I'm not sure I believe all of her motivations. They seem to me to be a bit contrived for third act. Developments and stuff.
So yeah, know? I mean, I sort of like, you know, my To Kill a Mockingbird thing. It's sort of like if somebody had given Harper Lee notes and said, you know, could we have a speedboat chase at the end? Could we work that in somehow? You know, that's kind of where I went with Mudd, where I felt like it was so sort of delicate and believable, and then suddenly it was just like bam, thing happening, and let's talk about our feelings and da da da. And it just, I don't know, it took me out of it somewhere. But leading up to that, it was so great that I absolutely think people should see this film. And you know, obviously, we'll have different takes on it.
Yes. Since,
you know,
also, Michael Shannon is in this. We should mention he was a star of Take Shelter.
The director's first film.
And they are great friends. Have you ever seen a Q&A with the two of them together?
No.
They should go on the road with their, like, banter and their stand-up routine.
Funny.
They're freaking hilarious
This is
together.
The least twitchy Michael Shannon performance you will see in a while.
Like, yeah, he's
pretty
really
low-key.
Yeah. And that includes him reading the Delta Gamma sorority letter.
Which, if you have not watched
it
online...
Please go find it. And I'm a DG, so I'm quite proud to say to see him reading this. But he provides some comic relief at times where this gets very tense and a little scary and dramatic. Michael Shannon is always there for these weird little interludes.
Right.
What is he? He's making contraptions in his trailer.
Yeah, he's like a pearl diver, and you know, the kids are borrowing like self-help books about how to talk to women from him, and you know, you know, the part of the story is that Ellis has this crush on this older high school girl who's really popular, and she kind of treats him like crap. And so between that and his parents breaking up, he really needs to believe in Mudd and Juniper and their romance. And so when even that winds up not being what he expected, you know, that sort of precipitates what happens in the film. But beautifully acted and really well done. I kind of wish that it had maintained its tone more, but I absolutely recommend it.
Really fast, we talked about in our Iron Man 3 review, which you should also click on, how it's so cool that Robert Downey Jr. does not talk to this kid as a kid.
Right.
No one ever talks to these kids as kids.
True.
And I like that about it, that they are handled as young adults and they
even
carry themselves.
Even if they're not ready to be.
Even if they're not emotionally there, and they carry themselves as young adults and they're talked to as young adults, and I like that no one coddles them, and they are very, very badass, strong, smart kids. Yeah. So our numbers are?
I give it a 7.9.
I give it an 8.9, so our average is... Wait, what did we say that was?
8.4.
Math is hard. So, 8.4 for us, but it's really, really high on the tomato meter. It was like 98% on the tomato meter. So if it's coming to your town, I think it was what, just like New York and LA last week?
Right? Yeah, I think it's slowly getting out there.
So
keep an eye out for Mud. It's a different film from a lot of things that are out right now, and really beautifully done.